Hi, my name is Jessica Hilt. Welcome, everybody that has joined on the conference call for the webinar today. You may or may not know me, but I work at UCSD, and I do something called technical outreach. Basically, I'm a cat herder, and that's what I do for my day job, but I also want to talk about a little bit about what I do in my spare time. So today we're going to talk about something called strategic storytelling. And strategic storytelling has been around for a long time, but it is a buzzword right now. We have a lot of articles that are coming out in business magazines that talk about strategic storytelling, but really don't do a really great job of breaking it down of what it means. So that's hopefully what I'm going to be doing for you today. So just a little bit about me. I was a student here at UCSD in 2010. When I graduated with a literature degree in writing, but I already had a full-time job as a manager for a tech company, and I worked for a company called CompleteCampaigns.com, and I worked in data and politics, and I absolutely loved it until my company got bought, and then I didn't love it so much anymore, so I decided that I was going to take some time off. So after I graduated, I attended a program called the Clarion Science Fiction and Fantasy Writing Program. It's a very prestigious program. Only 18 people get in, and I got to be one of the lucky 18. So I attended that program, and then I decided I was going to take some time off to write. And what I found out is that I was super, super lonely. So I found a nonprofit in town called So Say We All that worked on bringing people to the stage and to tell stories on stage. It was called Performance Storytelling, and we worked with veterans, and we worked with the blind, we worked with Native Americans, but we also just did gigs at bars in the evenings where we would take people and their stories, and we worked really, really hard on making those stories amazing and putting them on stage. So in 2010, I told my very first story on stage, and I absolutely loved it. And something strange happened in that I just kept telling stories. And eventually, I worked with So Say We All, and I became one of their teachers to teach storytelling. I run a generative writing workshop, but I also am a writing coach, and then I'm a producer. So I produce shows and make sure that everybody that goes on stage tells a really good story. So I have a very big, long background of telling stories on stage. But one of the things that I noticed is that storytelling didn't just stop on the stage. It, in business, became one of these differentiators between people who got their ideas adopted very, very quickly and people who didn't. So around this time, I took a position at UCSD, and I started putting together storytelling and business. And so I'm going to just break down what I learned from that experience and hopefully pass it on to you so that you can learn how to tell an amazing story and get your ideas adopted. So what is storytelling? In its basic form, it's cavemen sitting around telling stories in front of the fire, right? It's kids' books that you read at night, a once-upon-a-time fairy tale. And if we brainstorm for a really long time, you might get to the position where you remember that there's some storytelling that's done on the radio. If anybody listens to, NPR, maybe has heard a Radio Lab episode, you might remember that there's nonfiction stories that have been told really beautifully and really compellingly and have sucked you in those driveway moments where you're listening to something that is actual nonfiction, but is so compelling that you're just stuck in the driveway listening until the end of the story, which has happened to me with Radio Lab all the time. I love it. So that's storytelling in its essence. Now, if you were a lit major like me, or maybe if you remember writing stories in middle school, you may remember something called the Freytag Pyramid, and that's what a lot of people remember when we talk about storytelling. So it's exposition, rising action, climax, falling action, resolution. This triangle is what we're taught that's what storytelling is in its most basic form. But anytime I talk about storytelling, I get, especially with a tech audience, people who are in IT, people who work with, data, facts, and figures, I get the objection that we don't need a story. We have data, facts, and science that back us up, and therefore, I don't have to tell a story because the facts are what is important. Well, I have some facts to tell you why storytelling is super important. So there's a couple of different things that happen when you tell a story. First of all, storytelling activates different areas of the brain than facts and figures activate. That's the Broca's areas and the Wernicke, I'm not going to try to say it today, areas. Those areas of the brain are going to make your behavior change after hearing a story. So, for example, there was a study done where oxytocin was given to patients or experimental patients, and then they were presented with a situation. 80% of those people were more generous to a stranger than before the oxytocin. Storytelling activates those parts of the brain and activates things like oxytocin into the brain so that things like generosity are different after a story. Story is the only way to activate certain parts of the brain so the listener turns their story into their own idea and experience. That's what happens when we go to the movies, right? You'll watch a movie, you watch a TV show, and you cry. You're not crying because, the facts and figures that happened in the story. You're crying because you are making that experience your own. You're living that experience through a story. 65% of our conversations every day are personal stories or narratives. So there's a lot of science behind the data that says storytelling is very important to us. If I had to pick a second career or a third career or fourth career, I got a lot of careers behind me. I would say that evolutionary biologist is probably what I would have done next. And one of the cool things is evolutionary biologists have studied stories. And one of the things that they found with stories is that they think it helped us evolve. And why did it help us evolve? Well, first, stories help convey information. Okay, you want to get to the watering hole. Here's the story of how you can get to the watering hole. I'm going to make it compelling. I'm going to make it amazing so that you remember it so that later on when you pass it to your children, we all remember how to get to the watering hole. Stories help us bond. So anytime that you tell a story, you tell a personal story, that helps us bond as a society, as individuals, as a community. So stories helped us become groups of people. It also increased something called neurocognitive organization. And what that means is that they think that stories helped us remember things in more complex ways for longer, and that organization is all through stories. If you've listen to anybody who has done some of the competitions on how to memorize a deck of cards. It's the story of how they walk through a house. Stories help them memorize the entire deck of cards so that they could then repeat it. Same with neurocognitive organization. The last thing that is one of my favorite things, it's simulated dilemmas with no risk. So if we're told a story about why something is a taboo, or we're told a story about, hey, these people hiked Mount Everest and they all died, we don't have to say, oh, I'm going to go hike Mount Everest and see if I die. It's a simulated dilemma. We know that it's a risk. We heard the compelling story and we've made the decision not to go that path. So those are some of the interesting science behind it. This is a really great quote that I think just summarizes this information. A dispassionate brain that reasons through issues, a brain that weighs evidence, follows chains of reasoning, and pursues its best interest, is a brain that apparently does not and never has existed. So that's one of the things that I just want to take, I want you to take away, is that this brain does not exist, the brain that just works on facts and figures and science. If it did exist, we would, especially as we evolved, we would have different political results. We would have, different stories that are the top stories on the newsfeed. It is not the facts and figures that make those stories rise to the top. It is the storytelling that makes it rise to the top. So I just want to give you an example of how this can be applied in the real world. So University of Massachusetts Medical School did a study. They had a problem. They had a community of people that had uncontrolled hypertension issues. And this community was African American community. And what they decided is they wanted to see if they could get patients within their own community that had successfully been treated, if they could tell their stories to other patients, peers, they wanted to see what the result would be. And the result was they experienced a drop of 10 milligrams of mercury over patients that did not hear any stories. So that's basically the same result as taking medication. But what they saw is that people who heard stories from their own peers applied those stories to their own life quicker than knowing the facts and figures. For example, if you're told exercise and eating healthy will help you drop your hypertension, it is a different experience than hearing somebody who's a peer who's come from your situation who tells you the exact same story, but with their own personal bias behind it. So you might be asking, fine, but wasn't your talk about business and strategic storytelling? And absolutely, you're totally right. I'm a big fan of Venn diagrams, so I love to use Venn diagrams to explain everything. So strategic storytelling is the mix of creative storytelling, what I do with So Say We All on stage, and what I do every day at UCSC, finding facts and figures and science to support the claims. That is the mixture of strategic storytelling right in the middle. So let's break down strategic storytelling. Now, if we brainstorm strategic storytelling, we might come up with something like commercials. Strategic storytelling tends to leave a bad taste in our mouth. Oh, this is, you know, people trying to sell me something. Commercials, marketing, mission statements. Anybody who's read a mission statement knows that they're trying to tell a strategic story. If we brainstorm for a little longer, you might remember Kickstarter. Kickstarter requires anybody who gets on to Kickstarter to put together their own strategic story, how they came to be on Kickstarter, how they came to find what they wanted to do, their passion in life, and how this product is going to make the world a better place. But one of the things that I want you to keep in mind is that strategic stories are not just marketing materials. They're not just commercials. They're not Kickstarter. Anytime you hear a founder story, you know, IBM being built in the garage of somebody's house, that's a strategic story. That's a story that we remember, oh, you know, IBM came from these small beginnings and it grew into this major company. Impact stories, anytime we're talking about how a product had an impact on a community or how a product has made an improved lives. That is a strategic story. Client impact stories, the story from your client that says, oh, I didn't use this product. It was really, really hard to do what I needed to do, and now I use this product and it makes my life so much better. Those are always good impacts or good strategic stories. Your employees, what do they get from working at a company? What do they get from working in a department? What do they get from working on a team? And then what we always forget is that your own personal story is a strategic story. Anytime that you send a cover letter out, anytime you send a resume out, that is your strategic story. So I want to give you a little bit of data about strategic storytelling because we're doing some research on this recently in the business world. It's not something, it's a new and developing field, and I really love to see the research that comes out on it. There's a strong link between a strong strategic story and staff productivity, and that makes a lot of sense. If you know what your company is trying to do, if you know what your organization is trying to do, if you know what your project is trying to do, you're going to work harder towards that bottom line. If you're ambiguous on what any of those mean, what is the result that we're trying to achieve with a project, then you're not going to work as hard towards that bottom line. Three to one customers bought products that provoked an emotional response. And I'm sure you see this anytime that you turn on the TV. You're watching a Super Bowl commercial. There's a cute puppy. He runs across the kitchen floor and slips and he falls into his, you know, giant bowl of dog food. Oh, adorable puppy. I want to buy that dog food, right? I am absolutely a marketer's, like, biggest dream. Anything that provokes an emotional response, I think that we should buy. This is also why I should not listen to NPR, because every day I have a new cause. Storytelling is universal. It appeals to a culturally diverse group. So what that means is that when we're talking about how to make sure that we're reaching all the people within our organization, one of the things that's great about storytelling is it crosses all cultural divides. Every culture tells stories. So if they have a range of interests or learning styles, those are the people that you're going to reach with a story that you might not reach in other ways. Now, here's the thing that should scare you, because it scares me. We talked about the strong link between a strategic story and staff productivity. Well, surveyed 450 organizations, 80% of them said that employees did not understand their strategic direction. And anybody who's had to break down a mission statement can understand why. There's a lot of buzzwords in there. There's not a good thread of a narrative. You know, we might talk about synergy or collaboration or, you know, whatever the latest buzzword is. But if the employees don't understand what that mission statement at its heart means, it means that they don't have that strong link between a strategic story and staff productivity. So how can we change that? So we know that people are substantially more motivated by their organization's transcendent purpose, how it improves lives, rather than its transactional purpose, how it sells goods and services. Now, we can talk about this at a larger, bigger level, like from UC as a whole or from your campus as a whole, but we can also talk about this just from a project standpoint. What is your project's transcendent purpose? If you think your project doesn't have a transcendent purpose, you're probably not thinking about it long enough. Your project probably improves lives of a certain set of people. Maybe it doesn't improve lives of the entire world. I'm not asking you to do that. But if you can say, my project is going to fix this problem in our code, and the problem in our code has led to less students being able to log on and check their grades, then the transcendent purpose is we're improving the lives of students and their anxiety levels when they're trying to check their grades. That transcendent purpose is much better than telling a team, we're going to change our code so that it works faster. That's a transactional purpose. People are more motivated by the transcendent purpose. Okay, so I want to give you an example just about how strategic storytelling can be applied in small ways as well as large ways. So I'm going to tell you about when I interviewed at UCSD. So I had taken a year off. I had been writing. I just came. I worked 8 years at Complete Campaigns. I ran a bi-coastal support group and training program. So I had people in D.C. and people in San Diego. I had been doing it for a very long time, and I was incredibly qualified for the job. But I was super nervous because the job outline was about working with system administrators, and I had never worked with system administrators. I had done a lot of technical support. I had worked very closely with developers, but I didn't know a system administrator. So when I came into the interview, I knew that would be a question that would be asked of me. And so I knew I was going to have to tell them my story. So it was about halfway through the interview, the woman who would eventually become my boss asked me the question, how do you keep abreast of the latest technology and services with system administration? And I said, well, the first thing you should know about me is all I date is geeks. And the room laughed, and they thought that was funny, and it broke the ice. And then I started with my story. And I said, what I mean to say is when I the way I live life is I go through and I meet really interesting, wonderful people, and I get excited about what they're interested in. And I go and Google things that they want to talk about. Because if you've ever dated a geek or gone out to lunch with a geek, you'll know that you cannot fake your way through a conversation. They're going to call you on any technical knowledge that you are not amazing at. So I never try to be fake about it. I just Google it. I get to know what they're doing and what they want to do, and then I ask them questions about it. And in the course of the conversation, it was pretty clear that that was exactly what they needed to hear. They didn't want somebody who could come in and just be a system administrator. They have a whole bunch of system administrators. What they wanted is somebody who could go out to the community and bring together system administrators, and that's exactly what they saw in my story. So hopefully by this time you're like, Jessica, totally on board, but we got to get to the part where you tell me how to tell the strategic story. Okay, great. I hope you're super on board. If not, I'm so, so sorry. Talk to me later, and I'll try to convince you otherwise. But if you're on board, let me tell you how to tell a strategic story. So I break down strategic story into three areas. First, you have to start with the truth. Then we have the audience, and then the narrative. So the truth. The problem is that a lot of times strategic stories come off as something that we like to call the Pollyanna story. It is the best face of the story. okay, we're going to be working on this project, and yeah, we don't have all the resources, but it's going to be great, and everybody's going to love it, and we're never going to run into any obstacles, and everybody's going to love the end product, and oh my gosh, ready, set, go. You know, I can tell you how many project launches that I've been to that is a Pollyanna story. It's the best face of the product. It's the best face of the project. It is what a lot of times in management, they think what employees want to hear. What I'm here to tell you is that you need to talk the good, the bad, and the ugly. You need to talk about the truth. Talk about what is going to be the transcendent purpose of this project, but also tell them what are the parts that are going to be really, really hard. Are there going to be areas that are not going to do well? Are there going to be areas that are big unknowns? And then the ugly, what are their resources like? Is this going to be a project that's going to have a crunch time? Is this going to be a project that not a lot of people are going to be on, and so we're going to be working with minimal resources? If we give the people the truth, but we also include why we want to do this and how the outcome is going to be better, then people are going to buy it. So let me give you an example. Steve Jobs, I don't know how many of you remember MobileMe. I'm old enough to remember that. So MobileMe came out, and it was a giant, giant disaster. It's kind of the predecessor to iCloud. They were trying to put together the calendar and the email and their contacts and your photos and all that good stuff. And it kind of bombed. It didn't connect well. It didn't sync well. It was a big mess. So much later, Steve Jobs did a keynote about iCloud. And he came out, and everybody in the audience was thinking about MobileMe because they probably worked there. And when he started to talk, he talked about MobileMe, and he said it was not our finest hour. And there was this big pause in the audience, and the audience laughed. He got a lot of credibility at that point. You're building a rapport with the audience because you're pointing out, hey, we've done this before in the past. We didn't do a great job with it. We learn from those mistakes, and we're going to move forward. That's what people want to hear when they hear the truth. They don't want to hear the Pollyanna story. They don't want to hear how iCloud is going to send everything to the cloud, and it's going to be amazing, and yay. They want to hear, hey, remember when we tried this and it totally failed? Let me tell you how we learned from those mistakes. So I'm going to tell you my own story about this. When I worked at Complete Campaigns, this was the clip art that was on our website. I always told people I was the person in the pink on the right-hand side, which, of course, is a big lie because I'm not a blonde. But at Complete Campaigns, we worked with lots of politicians from all over the United States, and we filed reports with the Federal Election Commission. Now, the Federal Election Commission is an interesting place. This is where all the political reports are filed, and so anytime you've made a contribution over $99, your name appears on this report. Well, it was crunch time, filing time. People were filing reports, and we figured out that there was a bug in the software. And the bug in the software was putting a problem on the report that they were filing with the FEC. Now, to add to this problem, not only was that the problem, but to add to this problem, the FEC, when you file an amendment with the FEC, does not delete the previous report. It just shows both reports and the last one with the latest date. So what that means is that our clients, even if they filed an amendment, would file this amendment, and that problem, whatever the bug showed up on the report, would be there in perpetuity forever and ever and ever. So my boss came to me, Ben, who was an amazing boss, and he said, okay, Jessica, this is your call. How do we handle this? Now, to tell the truth, we could have absolutely lied. We could have lied to our clients. We could have never told them about the bug. We could have made a phone call to them and said, hey, I noticed you filed something wrong on your report. I think we can help you correct that, and you can file it with the FEC. Ethically, there's a problem with it, but our clients would never have been the wiser. We could have called them and say, I don't know what happened, but let's go ahead and file this amendment. But what we did instead is we sent an announcement to our clients, and we called them, and we said, hey, we totally screwed up. There was a bug in our software. We didn't catch it. I want to help you file a report, but just so you know, this is gonna live online. And the response was incredible. My clients would call me and say, here's the deal. We totally love you guys. We're so glad you told us the truth, because now if you call me and tell me there's a problem with my report, and you say it's my fault, I know that it is my fault. So that is why you tell the truth, is because when you want, when you need buy-in, they're going to have that rapport with you and totally help you achieve whatever strategic story you're trying to tell because you've got them bought in already. So if I love to quote myself in presentations because that's hilarious. The thing I would say is from the takeaway of that is embrace your failures. They're going to make great stories later on. So do that. Don't try to hide them. Okay, so the second thing that I want you to keep in consideration when you're telling a strategic story is the audience. So there's this strategy called push versus pull strategy. So everybody's very familiar with a push strategy. A push strategy when you're telling a strategic story is like when you go to the movies, when you watch a video. It is something, a story that is being told to you. It doesn't involve you. You're watching it. You are the audience for it. Now, what I would like you to consider is maybe talking about a pull strategy. A pull strategy is when you involve, I liken it to a role-playing game because, again, I'm a giant geek. If you're in a role-playing game, everybody plays a role in that game. Everybody plays a role in that entertainment. Yes, there is somebody who is behind the scenes who is the game master, and he's in control of the way that the game works, but all those people sitting around the table are involved in building that story together. What they have found is that push strategy versus pull strategy obviously is going to be more compelling for people. They want to be involved in the process. They want to see their own story up there. So I'm going to give you an example of how this worked in real life. So Canada had a problem. Canadian Board of Tourism had a problem. Canadians didn't think that Canada was exotic enough. I can understand. I never think of Canada and think, ooh, that's an exotic place to go. So their objective was to get Canadians to plan trips to travel at home and not abroad. So what they decided to do was a campaign called hashtag Where Is This? And it was a social media campaign, and they did buy some commercial time, though, and put it, you know, on broadcast television. But they did hashtag Where Is This? And it was a very simple campaign. They would have a hashtag Where Is This? And then a picture. And there was nothing more than just a beautiful picture of a place. And what it was is pictures of Canada. But I didn't know that was what Canada looked like, right? I didn't know it was someplace exotic. But what was interesting is maybe what they did not intend but happened is they got a huge response of people who knew exactly where those places were, who had been to those places, who had vacationed at those places. And so they would reply with the answer and with more pictures either of that place or stories about their own vacation there. The brand was also, they also provided the company with content. So one of the things that happened is that they had their first set of exotic pictures of Canada, and then people started adding their own exotic pictures of Canada, pictures that they did not pay for, the Canadian Board of Tourism didn't pay for, but their own family pictures, their own pictures of places. And so the Where Is This brand started to reach much, much farther than their initial buy-in, commercial buy-in. And people were telling their own stories. They were talking about these exotic places in Canada. Oh, you know, we went backpacking here, or, oh, we went scuba diving there. And those stories, because they were being told peer-to-peer, resonated a lot farther than just having an ad campaign about Canada being exotic. So the result was $500 million more spent in Canada that year than had ever been spent before. Pretty amazing result. So what does that mean when you are telling a story, right? How do you get the same kind of push versus or pull versus push strategy? How can you make your story a pull strategic story? Well, are all your stories top down? Are all your stories talking at a mission level way, way high from a CIO, from a CEO, from a manager? Are all those stories from a much higher level? Why don't we talk to people who are not just at a high management level? Why are we not talking about customers? Why are we not talking about the community that has, that our projects impact? Remember that you are who we are is not just what we do. So when we're telling a story, are you just telling a story of, oh, I want you to, you know, go visit Canada. We're super exotic. No, do it. We also want to talk about just how Canada is beautiful, and that's where we see all those other stories. So are we talking about what we do, or are we talking about who we are as an organization, especially working in a nonprofit, especially working in higher education? Talk about the greater good. We have the opportunity to tell a strategic story about how we are impacting, making an impact on the world and on communities and on students. It's amazing what we do, but we always forget about it because we're in IT. You know, we keep the lights on, so we forget that we're actually making a much larger impact on the world. Also remember that you're not Aesop's Fables. Remember with the Canadian campaign, nobody said, hey, Canada, we're exotic. The Aesop's Fable is, you know, don't tell the punchline of the story. Make sure that you're letting people come to that conclusion themselves. Okay. So the last thing that I want you to take a look at is the narrative. So let's go back to this. So Freytag's pyramid, right, middle school, exposition, rising action, climax, falling action, resolution, that can be applied to every single story that you tell strategically. Now, you might think, aren't you taking the fun out of it? Aren't you taking the fun out of story? If anybody remembers Dead Poets Society, again, I'm old enough to remember, was one of my favorite movies. There's this point where he graphs if a poem is worthy enough to be great. And it's this hilarious part where, you know, he's drawing on the board and, you know, talking about meter and rhyme. Yes, a lot of times when we talk about strategic stories, it feels like I am taking the fun out of it because I'm like, well, do you have your exposition? Do you know where it started, where your rising action is? I'm not taking the fun out of it because what people hate to believe, because everybody believes storytelling is so creative and it comes from this amazing ability that you're just born with, is that it's not. It's something that's learned in practice. And if I didn't firmly believe that, I wouldn't have a degree in literature and writing. I wouldn't try to teach people on the weekends on how to make a better story. I do believe it's something that can be taught. So, yeah, we are taking the fun out of it, but I promise it'll still be creative and amazing. So here's how you talk about the narrative. First, you have to set the stage. Then we have dramatic conflict, and then we're going to have a resolution. So setting the stage is how did we get here? So what has it been in the past? What's changing? What are the external pressures? And then what is the challenge? When you're talking about a project, when you're talking about a department, when you're talking about whatever you're doing strategically, there has been a past. We could talk about UCSD. We could talk about its founding. We can talk about what's changing. What is the higher education climate like right now? What are the external pressures? We could talk about the student debt. We could talk about for-profit schools. We could talk about private universities. And then what is the challenge? Is the challenge recruitment? Is the challenge retention? And you can do that with your project. What has your project been in the past? Well, we have this program, and it worked amazing for 25 years, but we haven't updated it in 25 years. Well, what's changing? Well, now we notice that it's way too slow, and we need to change with the times. We need to rewrite this in Ruby on Rails, or we need to write it in a more updated language. What are the external pressures? Well, we have all these clients that are asking for a faster system that's more agile and able to put things in the right place faster. What is the challenge? Well, we got a lot of challenges. We have resource challenges. We have challenges because we have to keep it up and running until this new product is in place. There's lots of challenges. And then what's the dramatic conflict? This is our turning point. Now, this is really, if I'm being honest, this is one of the best parts of telling a story because this is the unknown territory. This is the good, the bad, and the ugly part, right? This is the big what if. This is the change. And this is where you have to motivate people. This is where you're telling them, okay, I don't know if this is going to work, and I'm totally okay with that. We've got to try, and we may fail, but that's okay, and this is why it's okay. We have to try it, and we have to, if we fail, we fail, because it's worth it to try. You know, we could be talking about a project. We have to try this. If it doesn't work, it, you know, we may fail, but it's better than not knowing if we could make this better. In my own life, we could talk about I helped run a project called the Tech Wiki. We had to change from an old format to a new format. The new format was a little scary. The old format looked like it was from the 1990s. and I wanted to include way more people in the community. The big unknown territory was, are these new people who aren't usually coming to the wiki going to come to the wiki and try it out? Are they going to add their own content? Because if they don't add their own content, then the wiki is going to fail. And then you have to say, well, what's the option if we don't try? And if we don't try, then failure is already what happened. So we want to try, and we want to try to recruit. And we may talk about mitigating those failures. We may talk about, oh, we're going to send people out, and we're going to plant people who are really interested in this. But in general, you know, this is the change that needs to happen. Excuse me for that mute. I had to cough. All right. Finally, in the resolution, what is the call to action? This is when we are trying to inspire people. This is why we are trying to tell people, what is our transcendent purpose? How will this work for the greater good? But also, how can they play a role in it? Very few people want to be told their role. They want to come to their role with some kind of idea of what is inspiring to them. So if you're a big nerd like me, I'm going to talk about in Game of Thrones, Jon Snow, King of the North scene. Sansa should have been King of the North. I'm just going to put that out there right now. But Jon Snow comes and he meets with all these people who are kind of these minor kings of these areas, and he's trying to rally them. Now, he didn't come in and say, hey, I'm the King of the North. You should totally support me. What he said was, here's the deal. This is what's changing. This is what the external pressures are. If we don't do something, this is what's going to happen. And if we do something, we may fail, but we may succeed. And when he talks about how they could succeed and how failure, even though it's a total option, not doing anything is not the option. And they come to the conclusion that he's King of the North. He never says, like, oh, hey, I'm King of the North. So don't tell him you're King of the North. That's never going to work for you. No, don't tell him that this is the end-all, be-all product, that this is going to save all their, this is going to save everybody and all their issues will be resolved. Have them come to that conclusion themselves if that's the conclusion they come to. They may come to the conclusion like, you're right, we can't not do anything. We can't sit there. We have to make this change even if we do fail. Talk about what if it works. What is life going to look like if this product, if this organization succeeds? And then why is it okay to take the risk? Why failure is a risk and why it's okay and how it aligns to the bigger picture. One of the things that I want to warn people against, especially anybody in management, one of the things that I think really deflates a resolution is this idea that, oh, this is going to be easy to implement. This is going to be an easy change. If you've ever rallied anybody, if you've ever watched a sports ball movie where there's a locker room scene where they're trying to rally the troops, the coach doesn't say, is this going to be easy? You know, they say, is this going to be hard? And they're like, yeah, and they're still going to do it. So make sure you're not sugarcoating it. Remind people that this is going to be hard and this is going to be uncomfortable. Not only does it build that rapport, but it sets expectations up so that when it is hard in the project, your project won't fail just because it was difficult. So remember this slide? Data, facts, science. That is absolutely still valid. It's still part of the story. Just like this was a mixture between creative and data and science, strategic storytelling has to have facts. It has to have data. It has to have science. If it doesn't, it's just a fluffy story, right? We don't want to tell a fluffy bedtime story. We want to tell a strategic story, which means that we have to include the data, facts, and science in it. All right, so this is the part where I do questions and answers. I find questions and answers to be very, very hard, so just be kind to me, and I will try to...
The conference has been unmuted.
Oh, I will try to take as many questions as I can. So one of the questions that is being brought up in the chat is, what situations, conditions do you recognize that you need to come up with a strategic story? Anytime that I have to get buy-in for somebody other than the people that I'm in charge of, by the way, I have nobody that I'm in charge of. Anytime that I have to get buy-in from other groups, I know that a strategic story is going to come into play. Now, is it going to be a strategic story that is super long and in-depth and, you know, really is a half-an-hour presentation? Probably not. But it will talk about all the things that I pointed out. It will talk about where we came from, what's changing, what is the big unknown and the risk, why we can't do any, why we can't sit on our butts, and then what will happen if it does succeed. Can I give an example of a strategic story that I've used in my UC IT role? Sure. So let me talk a little bit about, I kind of touched on the Tech Wiki earlier. Let me just delve a little bit into the Tech Wiki. So when I joined UCSD, we had the SysWiki, which was a system administrator wiki that was written in a terrible wiki software. And for years, we loved it, and you know, people contributed to it, and we had a very active community on it. Last year, we knew that we were going to have to change platforms because the software was no longer supportive, and we brought it into Confluence. I decided that when we did that, that we would also open it up to developers. We would try to start building a developer wiki. At the same time, Research IT as part of Central IT was being created, and I got brought on in a small role to try to get research developers to buy into the Tech Wiki as well. And so what I did is I had I worked with Claire Mizmodo and Sid Burrows, part of Valerie Polishar's research IT team, and we went out and we met with the community. And we had, luckily, we had a few people who were already there who were really interested in getting that up and running. And we met with developers and basically told them the story. Okay, here's how research used to work. Now we have some external pressures, especially from our current current administration, where we may not get as much research money as we used to. So we need to collaborate and pull our resources. What is that going to look like? It's going to look like this Tech Wiki, which is going in and putting in information, you know, taking some time to write down your notes. This can be research projects that you're doing. One of the examples that was given is, hey, I'm like the only person that knows how to clean salt water out of a hard drive. I have, you know, detailed instructions on how to do that. Great. But what are the risks? Well, you could put all this time into putting this stuff on the wiki and then nobody could read it, or it could die, which has happened to lots of wikis and lots of documentation where people were really excited to put it together and then it kind of waned and then people weren't really excited. But I could also point to the SysWiki and say, look, we've driven this and it's, you know, it has a big community that's involved. We know how this works and we can help you make this a big community. And then, you know, as far as resolution goes, like, what does it look like if this does succeed? Well, you're going to get a lot more collaboration. You're going to know about things. If somebody needs a piece of software or, you know, they need storage, they might be able to make a connection through the wiki that somebody else is working on the same thing, and then they can talk about maybe buying that storage together. So that is a strategic story that, you know, a very abbreviated version of a strategic story that I've told in my technical community role to try to bring people behind an idea. How do I present these stories? What is the format, timing, et cetera? It depends on when I'm brought into a project. A lot of time I present these stories in like a PowerPoint presentation like today, but more often than not, I'm presenting it just on the fly in quotes, right? Because I practice these stories, I already know what I'm going to say, you know, they're speaking points. And it's usually at a project launch. But a lot of times I'm brought in when it's not a project launch, it's more when they have to do a community launch. So I might be brought in when we're deciding to go and talk to people and departments on campus to try to get them to buy into an idea that Central IT has about doing something. We want to use this software. We think other people would really want to use this software. We'd like to get, a campus-wide license. We might meet with departments, and then it's more of a roundtable thing, and it's much more abbreviated. A challenge I have is I want others to buy in, but I also need to convince them to give my project priority over others to get resources. Maybe my story just needs to be awesome. Well, sure, absolutely. I mean, honestly, it's all about who can tell the best story. But there are, don't get me wrong, if you tell this really great story about how you want, you know, to make software that does, I don't know, balloon animals for students, and they say, well, we really need to keep the lights on, so we're going to, you know, this project of keeping the lights on is going to, you know, going to have to take precedent. I totally can understand that, right? So, yeah, there is going to be, you're going to have resource problems. Now, I would say, do you think your project needs to be priority? If it does, then you need to just convince them. You just need to have an awesome story. And you may want to speak, you may want to spend some time understanding the transcendent purpose of your project. And if your project has a purpose of making life better for a segment of the population, talk to that population. Find out what would make their life amazing. Talk to your users and then incorporate that as part of your story. Because if your story doesn't have that, then maybe the people who are doling out the resources don't understand what the impact of your project is. I hope that helps. Do I have advice on PowerPoint and its role in presentations? I think PowerPoint should probably die a flaming death because it's used so poorly in presentations. My advice is going to be my advice, and I guess my advice alone. I don't know. I don't have any UCSD support on this, but PowerPoint should have the minimum amount of words possible. All the words should be coming out of your mouth, not reading off the slide. And I did read off the slide for part of this, but I hope not much. You know, I think there should be a word limit to slides. I have seen slides where I literally cannot read the words because they're so tiny, because there's so many words on the slide. Your story shouldn't be read, right? Your story should be something that is spoken. Now, what I will say that kind of is opposite of that is if you have slides that you need to send out to people, make sure your story is annotated in the slides. So you may have a set of slides that you just send to people. I am way too lazy. That's never going to happen. Or maybe I should say I'm way too busy. But I do annotate my slides in the notes so that my story is in the notes, you know, the facts and figures, so that people don't have to guess on what my intent was with a PowerPoint presentation. I hope that was helpful. There's really great books. I could probably send some recommendations out if anybody's interested. You can email me at jessica@ucsd.edu. I can go back to that slide if you'd like. All right, did somebody have a question that was not typed? I hear some unmuted people, so I didn't want to make them type if they just wanted to ask a question. No? No? Are there any other questions? All right. Oh, are you available to consult if we want advice on a specific project? I mean, you can shoot me an email. I will happily, I love to talk storytelling, so I'll happy to give you some advice or point you, you know, I can point you to, I have tons of TED Talks that are about storytelling that are flipping a door that I would love to send you. So if you're interested, send me an email and I'll be happy to. I wish to subscribe to your newsletter. Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you so much. I don't even have a blog. I love it. I'm so glad you found it helpful. All right. Well, I think that's probably the end. Thank you, everybody, for coming. It was such a big turnout. I'm so flattered, and I hope it was helpful. And, again, if you have any questions, feel free to send them to jessica@ucsd.edu. Or you can tweet me at BZZTBAA, and I'll be happy to do that. Or hit me up on Slack. Oh, my gosh. Is everybody on Slack? You should all be on Slack. If you're not on Slack, it's uctech.slack.com. You can log in with your UCEDU address. Totally do it. It's a great community out there. All right. I think that's it.